I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Employers hired more new workers last month in January than in any month in the past 3 years. 112,000 men and women found work. So along with 4% growth in the economy last quarter and a sizzling 8% growth during the quarter before that, are happy days here again? We're joined now by Mark Zandi, chief economist of economy.com. He joins us from Westchester, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Mark.
It's good to be with you.
Mark, in December, we were told at first only 1,000 new jobs were added. That was then revised upward to 16,000 new jobs. Now, a month later, January, 10 times that number of jobs appeared. Is this great news, period? What do you make of it?
It's good news. The job market's improving. We're certainly in a much better place today than we were 6-12 months ago, but it's still disappointing. 100,000 jobs is still not enough to ensure that this expansion will keep on rolling.
What kind of jobs were added?
We saw some job growth in healthcare. That's been a steady provider of jobs all throughout the past few years. Some jobs in educational services, some transportation jobs, distribution jobs. In the securities industry, we saw a bit more hiring, a little smattering of job growth in a number of different industries.
When you say that more jobs needed to be added, more like 150,000 at least, which is what analysts were predicting, what do you mean?
Well, we do need more jobs. We need at least 150,000 jobs per month on a consistent basis, and I think if we're going to feel very comfortable with what's going on, we're going to need jobs closer to 200,000 per month, and we're just not there yet. And there's still many industries that are laying off. All of manufacturing continues to reduce jobs. State governments are losing jobs, and we've seen job losses in retailing and other parts of financial services. So it's still it's better. We're headed in the right direction, but it's not there yet. We need to see a better job market.
Economics is an inexact science, Mark, but when an economy is growing at 8% and then 4% in the next quarter, does that automatically mean jobs?
Well, historically it has. We've seen much better job markets in times when we've seen such booming top-line GDP growth. Not this go-around. We just haven't seen it. Part of the problem is the global offshoring, the global competition. Part of the problem is that the cost of investing in a piece of equipment software is so much lower than the cost of investing in a new person. And part of it is that businesses are just figuring out ways to restructure, reorganize around different technologies that require less workers.
And it's often raised as an issue. Ironically enough, productivity is so high among American workers. Does that discourage employers from hiring?
Well, it makes it less necessary for them to go out and hire. If they can figure out how to use technology more effectively and to outsource different kinds of functions in a more efficient way, which is exactly what they're doing, they just don't need as many workers. And that's clearly a weight on the job market today.
Speaking as an economist, Mark, is it sort of the textbook case, however, that as an economy grows, the last thing to also grow is hiring?
That's true. First, you see an improvement in demand in production, and we've seen all of that. You see an improvement in profitability at businesses, and we've seen that. And then ultimately, you see new hiring, and we're just beginning to see that. So all the trend lines are in the right direction, and we should have a better job market a year from now. But we need to see it, and it has to happen soon.
Mark Zandi, chief economist at economy.com. Thanks, Mark.
It was a pleasure.
The news this morning was sickening.
The body of a beautiful 11-year-old girl, Carly Boucher, has been found. Joseph Smith is under arrest for the abduction and murder of Carly.
Florida's Sarasota County Sheriff Bill Balkwill announcing the discovery of the body of Carly Bruscia, the 11-year-old whose abduction was captured on a car wash security camera last Sunday. The sight of the 11-year-old being led away, apparently to her death, is chilling. Stranger abduction is rare. In 1999, 797,000 children were reported missing. Of those, 58,000 were taken by non-family members, 115 by complete strangers. But, of course, one is too many. Steve Daly is the executive director of RAD Kids, a national nonprofit organization that works with police departments and trains children to empower themselves. He joins us from West Harwich, Massachusetts. And, Steve, parents tell their kids not to talk to strangers. But I talked to a five-year-old who knew that but didn't know what a stranger was.
We need to change our education from stranger danger to dangers that are out there that are realistic for our children by giving children choices to trust their instincts and to realize that the behavior that is leading them into the problem is what their danger is, not a stranger per
right.
se.
You say you'd like to get rid of the word stranger. Well, tell us about the behavior. Is it getting too close to someone?
Sad to say that our children are still being tricked by, can you help me find my puppy? Children should probably know most of all that it's not their job to help a grown-up. Mm-hmm. A grown-up should get a grown-up for help. And I think if we could get that message across to children, that would probably be the most important because they could run from a grown-up and go get them a grown-up.
I understand that some families are coming up with code words so that children will know not to go with an adult unless they mention the code word.
Well, it's traditional that we've used passwords as part of education in many children's programs in the country. And they tend to work as long as the child understands that they have the right to say no to a grown-up. But the reality is that 85% of the time our children are abducted in this country, it involves the use of physical force when someone actually grabs a hold of them. And at that point, all the preventative education is really gone, and what they need is education on how to get away and a belief that they're capable of doing so.
Right.
Our statistics in this country are evasive in the fact that we actually don't know how many attempted abductions because most children don't even tell when they get in trouble. If they get away safely, which we hope, They don't tell their parents because they're afraid that they were going to get in trouble for talking to a stranger.
Steve, I've heard from people who have seen that horrendous tape and said, why didn't she scream? Now, we know you didn't know Carly, but you certainly know generally why kids can get led away.
The reality is our brain responds at a certain level of response, and there's a fight or flight response at the brain. And if it doesn't have skills and trained at that level, then basically it's a startle response and nothing comes out. Adults would do the exact same thing.
Well, again, there's so much information here, but what is one thing a child can do once they are grabbed and pulled into a car or behind a car wash?
Well, if a child understands that no one has the right to hurt them and they get grabbed, they can immediately respond. If they're trained physically, they can immediately respond to a target area such as the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
We've had 19 saves from abduction that we've been able to document in the first couple of years of our organization.
Mm.
And the interesting part is 17 of those required no physical contact. The child saw it coming, recognized the void, and got away before, which is our obvious goal. But two of them did require physical use, and one of them was actually with a weapon that was used, and the child still got away, and that was actually two young girls, 11 years old in Illinois, who were able to escape abduction because they kept their heads and were able to find a way to get away.
Steve, listen to us. I mean, isn't there a point where you can overdo training kids and frighten the heck out of them when the odds are that they are not going to be abducted?
Well, the reality is that's a myth. Education doesn't create fear. Education takes it away.
So make sure you find a program that makes a child feel good about themselves as opposed to just plain scared.
Absolutely. You can frighten a child if it's done improperly, but an empowerment program is certainly not going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is the kids don't believe in themselves, and if you don't believe in yourself, you can't do it. And there's a big difference between a child who is yelling, help me, and a child who's yelling, how dare you touch me.
Steve, thank you.
You're welcome.
Steve Daly, Executive Director of RAD Kids Personal Empowerment Safety Education. For more information, check out our website, here-now.org.
As we head into the next few weeks of primaries and caucuses around the country, front runner Senator John Kerry is still taking knocks from his Democratic opponents. But Republicans are increasingly getting in on the act, too, already building a case against Kerry, sometimes with just two words, Massachusetts and liberal. Patrick Healy of the Boston Globe has been on the campaign trail with Kerry since the fall. Welcome, Patrick.
Hi, Bill.
What about Kerry's accepting, for example, special interest money? Patrick, as you know, he says he'll sweep the special interests out of Washington and don't let the door hit you on the way out, he always says at rallies.
Yep.
But Kerry's taken more special interest money than any other senator. The AP's reporting just this morning, at least three times in his Senate career, Kerry recommended individuals for positions at federal home loan banks just before or after receiving political contributions from the nominees. How vulnerable is he on this score?
It's going to be tough. What he likes to tell people is that he's the only senator who's been reelected four times who has not taken any political action committee money. But he has sort of topped out as number one in taking money from individual lobbyists of all senators during the last 15 years or so. So in terms of his relationship with big money contributors, it's going to be a question that he's going to have to answer, and especially any signs of special favors.
Yeah, we should point out that Kerry's office said, as have the nominees in question, that the timing of the donations and the nominations was a coincidence. Many Republicans, Patrick, of course, furious about the Supreme Court decision in Kerry's home state of Massachusetts allowing gay marriage. What is Kerry's position on that? How does he handle that connection?
Kerry says that he's against gay marriage, but he favors civil unions if states decide that they want to go that route. But he says that he opposes gay marriage. And when asked yesterday by reporters whether he would support a constitutional amendment to the Massachusetts Constitution that would essentially ban gay marriage, he said that he'd want to look at the language. So he didn't rule it out entirely. He thinks that this is a real wedge issue for Republicans and Democrats, and that he doesn't want to play that game.
You know, I heard a conservative talk show host the other night railing about Kerry's voting against defense spending bills in the 90s.
But he supported basically a freeze on defense spending and opposed some weapons programs, procurement programs that some Republicans had supported. Kerry seems to, in a way, sort of relish this debate as a decorated, you know, Vietnam War veteran, as someone who has decades of experience on the Foreign Relations Committee. He thinks that he can win that debate.
Patrick, you know this politician well. The Republicans have already said they've got a stack of documents of ways to go at Kerry.
There are, absolutely. I mean, he's got a 19-year voting record in the Senate. Both Republicans and Democrats wouldn't have any problem trotting out, an issue or two, a vote here and there. We saw that very much during the Democratic primary. There's John Kerry's record as a Vietnam War protester after he came back from the war that some Republicans want to go after to undermine Kerry's support among veterans and the veterans community. There's probably issues in his personal life that I know Republicans have mentioned to me that they might look at. There is great concern among Republicans about Kerry's national security credentials, about him being a decorated war hero, and the contrast that the Kerry camp is already raising with President Bush's service record during the early 70s.
Whoever's the nominee, it's not likely to be pretty. Patrick Keeley, thanks very much.
Thanks, Bill.
Patrick Keeley of the Boston Globe, who's been on the campaign trail with John Kerry since last September.
Just ahead, the most powerful man in Iraq isn't U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer, but rather an Islamic scholar Bremer has never met.
And later, a new movie about near death on a South American mountain.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The most powerful man in Iraq is almost certainly not the United States top man there, Paul Bremer, but someone else, Ayatollah Ali Sistani. 15 million Shiite Muslims, 60% of Iraq's population, revere Sistani, who is an Islamic quietist, meaning he's against mixing politics and religion. Still, the Ayatollah wants direct elections, one man, one vote. Coalition officials strongly oppose that. Anthony Cordesman is a senior fellow at Washington's Center for Strategic and International Studies. Anthony Cordesman, who is Ayatollah Ali Sistani?
Well, he is certainly a very serious religious scholar. He was born into a family of Shiite clerics in Mashhad in Iran in 1930. According to reports, he began studying the Quran when he was only five, and at 19, he moved to Qom, which was a religious center in Iran with several theological schools. About 3 years later, He moved to Iraq, and at that time in Najaf, many of the religious teachers in Iraq were Iranian. He became very closely associated with the most senior cleric in Iraq as a student, the Grand Ayatollah Khoi. And as a result, when he was only 31, Sistani was made one of the few senior scholars ever selected at that age that had the right to issue, for example, legal judgments. Now, when Khoi died in 1992, he became the successor to Khoi as really one of the most senior clerics. And the other two potential senior clerics in Iraq died within a few years, and that left Sistani as the most senior religious figure in the country. Of course, it did so at a time when Saddam Hussein was cracking down on the Shiites and fighting a low-level civil war. And as a result, for the period from roughly 1992 or 1994 to the liberation of Iraq, Sistani was always very quiet, avoided any kind of political activity, and even so, had his main mosque shut down and was denied the ability to really run the Khoi Foundation.
Avoiding political activity, including now, at least overtly, he has not been willing to speak to American officials who now essentially run his country. How come?
Well, there are several reasons. One, he has in the past taken the position that for clerics to become directly involved in political power is corrupting, that it involves them in secular issues for which inevitably the decisions involve compromises, that it distracts them from their religious duties. In terms of direct contact with the U.S., it is in many ways a protective buffer, because if he was to meet with U.S. officials, there would always be questions about what was said, what level of dialogue took place. Did he somehow become influenced by U.S. officials? And certainly he wants to preserve that distance. But I should note that since the liberation, he has become much more active politically, and he's been able to resume control over the Khoi Foundation, at least a much more direct control, and that foundation reaches far beyond Iraq. In fact, it has branches in New York, and it's headquartered in London.
Anthony Cordesman, when a lot of Americans hear the word Ayatollah, they think of Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran. Ayatollah Ali Sistani is a very different character?
Very different, and so are virtually all Ayatollahs. You have to remember that Khomeini had to put the senior Ayatollah under him, under house arrest, even though at one point he was named his successor. Virtually all of the Ayatollahs in Iran at the time Khomeini came back from Paris resisted the idea of having a supreme religious leader. And Iraqi clerics, at least serious ones, while they have called for more observance to Islamic custom and Islamic law, have never come out and said that there should be any kind of theocracy or any kind of religious rule in Iraq. And I think we need to really understand that in general, the Shiite branch of Islam has been relatively democratic, has avoided becoming directly involved in secular power.
For all his quietism, Ayatollah Ali Sistani's quietism, is the United States taking as much advantage of him, and I mean that in a good way, as it should be? What are your thoughts on that?
From the outside, it would appear that it is not. And that may be as much because of neoconservative and ideological pressure in Washington as any efforts on the part of the Ambassador Bremer and the CPA. There have been a lot of difficulties as people in Washington have tried to block ties or contacts with the Shiite clergy, sometimes fearing that something like Iran might come to power, sometimes simply supporting exiled leaders. But in general, the real issue here is there are compromises being discussed, and a lot of them have not been made public for obvious reasons, and the exposure would almost kill the possibility of negotiation. Some of them are to hold less, shall we say, structured elections than we would really like, using the registrations under Oil for Food or other registrations under the census. Some proposals exist to hold elections in those governance which are secure and find a process elsewhere, or to add democratically elected delegates and remove the level of control or veto power of the governing council. And I think it's perhaps a little unfair to try to judge what's going on, particularly because the UN hasn't fully reported yet. And an awful lot of the options and negotiations that are taking place have simply never been made public. So we're talking a process which at best is going to be evolutionary, which isn't going to be a copy of the United States, and certainly is going to have to evolve over a period of, say, half a decade or even a decade or more.
Anthony Cordesman, Senior Fellow at Washington's Center for Strategic and International Studies. Mr. Cordesman, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
It took just 2 seconds for Justin Timberlake to assault, apparently with her permission, Janet Jackson during last week's Super Bowl halftime show, exposing her breath to the world. In those 2 seconds, the world was also exposed to what many American kids are seeing every day: sex, violence, violence presented as sex, and the people selling it to them, some of the biggest media conglomerates in the world. Is there a mega media problem bigger than the mini exposure of a breast? Joining us on the line, members of our Friday editorial roundtable, Pat Walker, editor of the Bucks County Courier-Times in Levittown, Pennsylvania. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Robin.
And Tom Maroney, columnist at the Metro West Daily News in Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Tom.
Good afternoon, Robin and Pat.
Well, start off with, you know, I said Justin Timberlake assaulted her. Your first reaction?
Well, that's, I think it's, you know, with all due respect, Robin, right, that's utterly ridiculous. This was planned. Janet Jackson has come out and said, I did this. This was my idea. It may have been a portrayal of an assault, but to point any blame at all at Timberlake, a 23-year-old,
seriously,
who was manipulated by this 37-year-old has-been diva, is to me, it's interesting. I haven't heard it until now, but I'm just in total disagreement with you.
Pat?
I'm sort of in the middle. I think it's her fault. I think he showed extremely poor taste in agreeing to do it, so he shares some of the blame, but I can't say it's assault.
Boy, I tell you, of course, you know, assault is extreme. It was, as you say, Tom, an acting out of an assault, mm-hmm. But what do you think little kids saw it as?
I think little kids, even the smallest kids, have been desensitized by now. And I think there was, as been pointed out all week, I think there was a lot worse, a lot more coarseness and, I dare say, obscenity going on in and around the Super Bowl than this one act.
Well, I guess I presented that way as well because Janet Jackson is not going to be at the Grammys. She was scheduled to be a presenter. We're not sure why, if she was banned or if she withdrew, but she's not going to be there. Justin Timberlake is going to be there. He's nominated for 6 Grammys. This is being called Janet Jackson exposing her breast, but in fact, she was complicit, but he's the one who reached across. I want to read you a little something from Derek Jackson, syndicated columnist in today's Boston Globe. He's writing about the the Super Bowl flap. But further down, he says, the Janet Jackson-Justin Timberlake breast-bearing was merely the exclamation point. On Super Bowl Sunday, an 11-year-old girl was abducted off the streets of Sarasota, Florida, an abduction that horrified Americans with a videotape of the crime. Yet the halftime show featured Timberlake stalking Jackson around the stage, feeling her up from behind and singing, I'm Gonna Have You Naked by the End of This Song. Of course, that poor girl has been found dead. But Tom, the point that is made is this is what kids are watching. That wasn't sex. That was a stalking.
Yeah, it was. And for Derek Jackson to compare that to what happened during the Super Bowl is also ridiculous. I mean, this was a plan hatched by Janet Jackson. She got what she wanted out of it. I mean, you have to look at the subtext here, Robin, the motive here. She wanted to sell more records, and apparently she did. Now, she's out of the Grammys. I may go as far as to agree with you to say that maybe Timberlake should have been out of the Grammys, too. But, you know, I think generally it's much ado about nothing. I think you're buying into the Republican agenda at work here.
Wait a minute. Women's groups and Democratic-backed women's groups are as outraged about this.
Yeah, but what they ought to be outraged at is the fact that Michael Powell, the son of Colin Powell, got up and called this crass, deplorable, and baseless, and on and on and on, to remind everybody in this election cycle that the Republican Party is the party of family values, that if you hand this over to the quote-unquote liberals, you're going to see even more skin during the Super Bowl. So beware, folks. And I think that's really how I feel manipulated by this.
Pat?
I just wonder where this would all have gone, and if there would be as much outrage if her breast hadn't been bared. Because except for that few moments, wasn't it equally as offensive what the lyric was, the way they were dressed, the suggestive motion? We don't, you know, is there, and that's on MTV and music videos every day.
What about the other aspect of this, that, you know, the idea that CBS was producing the show, Viacom owned CBS, and MTV had the halftime show? We were talking in the office about how offensive some rock groups maybe 20 years ago were to people. But it occurs to me that those groups were anti-establishment, and now this rock and roll, this entertainment, is being produced by the establishment.
I find it very interesting that MTV sort of has escaped a lot of the furor over this. And I wonder if Timberlake and Jackson are so apologetic because they know, were they to be banned from MTV, what would happen to their careers?
Well, I also think what's going on here, Robin, is that MTV, people know MTV for what it is, and this is expected of MTV. But let's, you know, I want to make a correction here that I think is pretty important. I finally saw the exposed breast up close on the internet, and it was not a bare breast. Now, I know that may sound silly to you, but it was covered by something. So what are we to make of that? If Powell's going to fine them for this, shouldn't he be fining the Baywatch reruns or the other things that show scantily clad actors and actresses?
Sure, the red carpet before the award shows, well, when J-Lo's dress barely covers her body.
You know, I want to stay with both your criticism of the FCC, Tom, and the question of media conglomerates, because next Wednesday, the very same FCC is going to ask an appeals court in Philadelphia to allow new rules to go into effect that would allow even more consolidation of media ownership. Do you think that that has anything to do with what's happened to entertainment, or does the fault, dear Brutus, lie in us?
Here's what I think. I think Powell's pounding the table and saying this is outrageous is, in a sense, a diversion. Because there are, if you want to be outraged by something that truly has significance in my mind, then you'd be outraged by the idea that the FCC is loosening requirements for what they call diversity on the air. In other words, they're allowing these conglomerates to own multiple stations and multiple medias in the same market. That is much more troublesome to me than a piece of MTV entertainment slipping into the Super Bowl.
Hmm. But, Pat, forget the exposure of the breast. How about the simulated masturbation or, you know, the fact that CBS refused to take a MoveOn.org political ad about the president's deficit? Do you think media conglomeration has anything to do with it?
I don't think so. I think it's all about promotion and attraction and pushing buttons. And they get the benefit of media conglomeration because they can reach a wider audience with the different stations and appeals they offer, but I think it's all about pushing buttons.
Well, I think Pat raises a great point. I mean, you look at other venues, other media outlets, and they're having this problem, too. There's a coarsening of the language, a coarsening of the subject matter. But, Robin, I think there is a legitimacy in what you say. The bigger and more powerful these companies get, the more difficult it becomes to find them or to pick on them. And I think it goes to a general criticism that perhaps the Democrats have of this Republican administration, that they're, quote-unquote, taking care of their buddies who own these big media outlets.
It's funny because you say there's a coarsening of the language, but these are the companies that are producing the records, owning the radio stations that they're restricting to playing only the records that they produce, owning the television stations, putting on the halftime shows. They are controlling the national entertainment dialogue.
And unless the FCC gets tough with them, we will see this trend continue. You're right about that.
Hey, I want to thank you both.
Thank you.
Okay, Robin.
Tom Maroney, columnist at the Metro West Daily News in Framingham, Massachusetts. Pat Walker, editor of the Bucks County Courier Times in Levittown, Pennsylvania.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Howard Dean says he's got to win the Wisconsin primary February 17th in order to stay in the Democratic race for the presidential nomination. Right now, the former Vermont governor is 0-for-9 and lowering expectations for this weekend's three contests. Well, certainly his supporters could use a boost. This past Wednesday, many of them gathered at different spots around the country to mark the one-year anniversary of the first so-called Dean meetup. Here announced Sean Carberry went to one where the mood was somewhat somber.
The Middle East Restaurant in Cambridge, Massachusetts, is one of the most storied rock clubs in the Boston area. But at the moment, it's playing host not to American Hi-Fi or the Real Kids, rather a Howard Dean meetup. Dozens of Dean diehards file into the downstairs room at the club, and Shy Sachs calls the event to order over a tiny crackling PA system, dwarfed by the massive stack of speakers at the front of the stage.
So, just a quick question. How many people here, is this your first time coming to a meetup? That's great. I think fantastic, especially since we've been getting a lot of bad news lately.
My name is Brian Richardson, and I live out in Davis Square, and I was an organizer in Iowa. And I think we would be remiss if we didn't sit here and say to ourselves that we're feeling a little bit down.
When I first came here this evening, I expected mainly to see diehards, and so it is pleasant to see people who have never been to a meetup before. There's been frequent mention so far that this is all bad news, and I don't know that we should necessarily look at it that way. It's just part of the fact that there's a whole system in this country that's stacked against us.
Hi, my name is Amy Carpenito.
How long have you been a Dean supporter?
Probably 6 or 7 months. I'm kind of in the beginning stage, just learning a lot about him.
Do you have faith that he can still win the nomination?
I want to still have faith, but I'm willing to support him until... I do have some faith, actually. I do.
You sound like, though, there's a point at which you're going to give up hope.
I feel like I sound like a lot of people. There's a point where I'll just support anybody that's going to beat Bush.
My name is Will Ashley. I'm a web developer. I've been involved in the Dean campaign since probably last August.
Are you worried about how he's doing right now?
There is still definitely a window of opportunity. I have faith that he can pull it off, and I'm going to stay with the campaign as long as he does.
All right, my name is Kate Cunningham.
Are you confident that he can still pull out the nomination?
Do you want the correct answer?
I want the honest answer.
I think it's going to be a tough battle for him, but I am hopeful. It's kind of the idea that if you believe in the candidate and what he stands for, that makes him electable. I know a lot of people have talked lately about the electability of John Kerry, but to me, Dean is just as electable because I believe in what he stands, and I would hope that other Americans would agree with that.
This campaign is about changing the Democratic Party.
Tell me your name.
Lisa Callender-Williams.
What's your sense of the mood here tonight?
It's almost like a support group tonight. People who really committed and worked really hard, went all over the country. I think we're just kind of holding each other's hands, saying, we know we have something good, let's just put our heads together and figure out the way that we can really spread the word.
Here now, producer Sean Carberry at the Dean Meetup this week in Massachusetts. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The new film, Touching the Void, tells a story now legend among mountain climbers. In 1985, Joe Simpson and Simon Yates decided to take on the western face of Sula Grande, a peak in the Peruvian Andes. No one had ever reached the summit. Simpson and Yates did. But on the way down, Simpson slid out of control on the snow and broke his leg severely. Yates then tried to lower his friend down the mountain by the rope that tied them together, until Simpson fell off a cliff and hung dangling over a crevasse. Yates made a crucial decision.
Then I remembered that I'd got a penknife and the top of my rucksack. I took a decision pretty quickly, really. To me, it just seemed like the right thing to do under the circumstances. Because there was no way that I couldn't maintain my position where I was. Sooner or later, I was going to be pulled from the mountain.
Simon Yates cut the rope holding the two friends together, sending Simpson hurtling into the crevasse. For days, Yates thought his friend had lost his life. Miraculously, he had not. Joe Simpson told his story in the book Touching the Void, which is the basis now for the new film. Joe Simpson joins us in the studio. Welcome, Joe.
Hi.
Joe, let's get this out of the way first. Simon Yates' decision to cut the rope was a topic of ferocious debate in the climbing community, but it's never been an issue for you.
No, I think it shocked people so much, climbers anyway, that they got blinded to the fact that Simon had done the most extraordinary single mountain rescue before he cut the rope. But as soon as the book was written, all criticism stopped because it exonerates Simon completely. It's dedicated to him, and now the film does the same again.
Well, the film is told in semi-documentary style by Academy Award-winning filmmaker Kevin MacDonald. He had interviews with both you and Simon Yates intercut with recreated scenes filmed in the Alps and the Andes, and the mountains themselves are almost another character in the film. We have a clip describing the Peruvian Andes.
It was this Andean nightmare of flutings of the finest powder gorged out by snow falling down, meringues and mushrooms and cornices all over the place. It is some of the most precarious, unnerving and dangerous climbing I've ever done.
You could almost have made a movie about the ascent of Sula Grande, which no one had ever done. It was on the descent that you broke your leg. Bring us there.
When Simon cut the rope, I mean, I didn't know he'd cut the rope. I thought he'd fallen off. I was in a terrible state at that point. I fell 80 feet through the air, hit the roof of a crevasse that was covered over, and it almost stopped me. And then I broke through and fell another 70, 80 feet into the crevasse and then smashed into a snow ice bridge. When I sort of got my senses together and made myself safe, I looked at the rope going up into the ceiling of the crevasse, and I thought, well, Simon's body's on the end of that. I thought if I pulled tight on the rope, it would it'd come tight on his body, which would act as a counterweight, and I could climb up the rope. But, of course, there was a sort of... and there was the frayed end of the rope, and it meant two things. It meant Simon was alive, and he had my knife. I mean, the point is, if Simon had solid anchors, I couldn't climb up the rope. He'd have been able to leave me hanging there. Well, I'd have died in 2 or 3 hours from hypothermia. It was minus 20. There was a 40-mile-an-hour wind. That's a wind chill of between minus 60 and minus 70. So the crevasse gave me shelter. I just found shelter in rather an extreme way.
Simon Yates, in thinking he'd sent you hurtling to your death, had actually saved your life.
Ironically, and also, you see, when Simon took shelter that night, he just hoped to God that I'd survived the fall. He hoped I'd fallen about 10 or 20 feet, and then I was digging a snow cave for myself. It was only in the morning when he came down and nearly died trying to down climb. He saw off to one side this huge overhanging cliff and this big crevasse, and he just knew I was dead at that point, and that's why he left. I mean, it's as good as watching somebody getting shot in the head. If you think somebody falls into a crevasse unroped, 99.9% of the time, you die.
So, Joe, you're in this crevasse, and you make the only decision you could make. You decide to try to make it down the mountain. Let's hear another clip from the film.
I genuinely believed that I wouldn't make the distance, and I also believed that I was going to die, and I sort of acknowledged it in a very matter-of-fact way. And it seemed very rational to keep on crawling if you didn't think it was going to be of any good. I think that it was that loneliness, that sense of being abandoned, was there all the time. I didn't crawl because I thought I would survive. I think I wanted to be with somebody when I died.
I was trapped in this crevasse. You don't die of a broken leg. You die slowly of hypothermia and dehydration. I couldn't climb up. I couldn't go sideways. And despite it being completely counterintuitive, I realised the only thing I could do was lower myself deeper into the crevasse. And I lowered myself about another 80 feet, and I found a way out. I mean, my lower leg had been driven through my knee joint, and my heel and ankle were broken, so it's extremely painful to climb out. But when I got out, I saw Simon's tracks on the glacier, and I knew that the only person who could possibly help me thought I was dead. And I then had to crawl over about 7 or 8 miles of huge boulders and rocks without food and water for the next 4 days. I arrived at 3 a.m. of the fifth day, in the dark, in a delirious state. I screamed out, and then suddenly there was Simon. He was about 200 yards away, and he was leaving the camp 3 hours later at 6 a.m.
You said there was a voice in your head that kept you going.
Yes, it was never a spiritual sort of side of it. I was brought up as a Roman Catholic. When I was 16, I lapsed, but I always thought, you know, if things really went bad for me, that I might turn around and say a few Hail Marys and say, get me out of here. And I never did in those days in Peru. And the voice I'm talking about was actually much more pragmatic. There was part of my brain was saying, get up, crawl, do this. The other half of my brain was just going completely mad, and I think it was like a form of sensory deprivation. I'd been alone for so long. Although, oddly enough, I never thought about my loved ones. I never for one moment thought about my parents or anybody I loved. I not because I'm a particularly nasty person, but because I didn't have time for that. It sounds a bit odd, doesn't it? I think if I'd thought of my loved ones, it might have weakened my resolve.
Joe, in the film, many of the reenactments, Brendan McKay and Nicholas Aaron are recreating a lot of what happened in the Alps. But you and Simon also went back to the Andes, didn't you, and filmed some of the scenes of your own harrowing experiences there.
Yeah, well, I think it was partly budget constraints. It was cheaper to send me and Simon back than to send the actors. And I didn't actually think it would affect me very much. And they dressed me up in the clothes and made me crawl on the same rocks. But actually, I found it very, very distressing. And started having panic attacks and all sorts of. When I got back to England, I was diagnosed as having post-traumatic stress disorder, which
you hadn't really experienced back in 1985 when it all happened.
No, partly because I was in full survival mode, and even you know where the film ends is when I get to Simon. But in real life, I got to Simon at 3 o'clock in the morning. 3 hours later, the donkeys turned up because he was leaving, and they brought a mule up with a saddle, and I had to ride a mule for 2 days, 10 hours a day, and then I had to go in the back of a pickup truck for 21 hours. Before I got any medical help. And I think what caught me out is I've told the story so many times in the last 17, 18 years that it becomes somebody else's story. But going back to Peru and going to the place where it happened, the memories came back with quite shocking lucidity. And well, I just went off my head for a bit. I mean, when I got back to England, they tried to get me an appointment for therapy. And I don't really agree with counselling and therapy, but lucky the British health system is in such a mess. It took them 6.5 months before I got an appointment, by which time I recovered. And I don't actually think about it like that. This happened 18 years ago, and I've got the rest of my life to live, move on, carry on climbing, do different things, write more books. Don't sit there thinking, God, I had a hard time, and, you know, God, I'm miserable, and my legs hurt, and all that. You know, just forget it and move on.
What did you learn? How were you changed by this experience?
I suppose I learned, I mean, if you'd asked me if I could have done this before it happened, I would have laughed at you. So I learned that you can be far stronger and far weaker than I'd ever thought possible. And yet I don't think in any way I feel exceptional. I mean, everybody would try and do it. Whether they succeeded or not is dependent on circumstance. And I was a mountaineer. I could make the right decisions. You would try just as hard as me, but you'd probably make the wrong decisions and they would kill you. But you wouldn't stop fighting.
Joe Simpson is the author of several books, including Touching the Void, which has now been made into a new film. Joe Simpson, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
Have a good weekend and join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.